for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. A Haitian court charged 10 American missionaries with child abduction. They were arrested last week while taking a group of children from earthquake-ravaged Haiti to the Dominican Republic. Iraq's Independent Elections Commission postponed the start of parliamentary races. Officials said they need time to determine who is eligible to campaign after a ban was lifted on hundreds of potential candidates. And nuclear-armed rivals India and Pakistan could begin high-level talks for the first time in 2 years. Joining me for the international portion of the Friday News Roundup, Brian Bender of the Boston Globe, Elise Labatt of CNN, and Yoki Driessen of the Wall Street Journal. As always, we welcome your calls, questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Remember, you can reach us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Big snowstorm on the way here to the Washington area, but we'll try to ignore what's happening outside. Yoki Driessen, Haiti has filed charges against American missionaries they arrested last week. Tell us a little about what's happened. Is this confusion? Is it well-meaning? What's going on?
Or is it some combination of the two? I mean, this was a case where American Christian missionaries went to Haiti, filled a minivan or a bus with some number of Haitian that they first said were orphans, although it later came out many of them still had living parents, and drove to the Dominican Republic, to the border, where they were stopped and where this became more of an issue. And the question it raises in the first case is, what is the legal provenance of these children? I mean, were all of them orphans or, as later reporting has suggested, were some of them still having parents living? And also the question, legally, when the Haitian government effectively no longer exists, what happens to the system of adoption? I mean, in most countries, Haiti included, it's usually fairly tightly controlled by the government. Here, the government no longer operates. So you have situations where you could have well-meaning people trying to take orphans, and you could have people who are motivated by religious fervor or other reasons taking children without permission from the families. And the third factor making this even thornier is, given that Haiti is, as we know, in such a terrible shape right now, you have living parents who might, with the best of intentions, offer their children to a missionary out of the belief that their children would have a much better life outside of Haiti.
When we call them missionaries, were they attached to any particular organization, or did they simply label themselves missionaries, Elise?
Well, it's unclear. I mean, many of them were Baptists that belonged to this group in Idaho. They were said, even before the quake, they were setting up an orphanage in the Dominican Republic for Haitian children. And so then they were getting ready, they were setting it up, they were getting donations. And then when the quake came, they kind of went down there very quickly and started working on behalf of getting out these children. What's clear is that they didn't have any passports for the children. They didn't have any documentation. They didn't check with any Haitian authorities. They just kind of rounded up the kids and took them out. And, you know, even if they didn't follow the procedures, many think that, you know, they had their hearts in the right place. But as Yoki said, I mean, it opens up a lot of questions as to, you know, what is going to happen to all of these Haitian children now. Many of them were orphans before the quake. Many of them were left orphans. And many of them have parents that are looking for them throughout the country. And with the Haitian government so weak right now, not really able to get a hold of all of these children, they're very susceptible to trafficking, very susceptible to abductions, you know, kidnappings, all kinds of things.
Brian Bender, since their arrest, the U.S. has been saying that U.S. citizens have to obey the rules of the country they're in. But as Yoki says, there are hardly any rules going on right now.
Well, I think maybe that's the broader lesson from this episode, which is, you know, this provides a pretty stark view of how desperate the situation really is in Haiti. Without social services, without any real semblance of governance, there's a whole host of other bad things that, you know, unfortunately are going to happen. And I think it's a reminder to the United States and other governments that are helping Haiti that this is going to be a very long-term effort if it's going to try and control some of this.
There's another element here in regard to Haiti and the United States, which is that many of those wounded, seriously wounded in the earthquake, have been forwarded here to U.S. hospitals. The question becomes, how long will they stay? Who will pay for their treatment? Will they be sent back to Haiti? A whole host of questions, Brian.
Well, I mean, certainly the question of whether they would be sent back to Haiti, I think, is going to be a critical one. I mean, because unless the situation there shows some progress, I think they could, you know, realistically or justifiably claim asylum. That, you know, how can you send me back to this place that has very little government? Obviously, it's a crime-ridden place, even when the, you know, before the earthquake. So, you know, I think the U.S. State Department is going to have to work through a lot of these issues.
Well, there's a Department of Homeland Security set up what's called temporary protective status. And originally that was for Haitians that were already in the United States when the quake happened.
Right.
Illegals would not have to be sent back. It seems as if some of these people that were brought over would also have this temporary protective status. But it does open up questions. Who's going to pay for it? You and me and the American taxpayer is going to probably pay for their health care. But at the same time, I mean, with the United States making such efforts to help the Haitian people that you can't be seen when Haitian people are trying to get out. And there have been a lot of messages to Haitians, stay home. You're not going to come to the United States. We're not going to let you in. Haitians that are already there can't be seen as being kicked out of the country. But I think the United States really is trying to put the Haitian government, even if they're not actually conducting the services, even if they're not actually governing the country, they want to put a Haitian face on all of this. And that's why not just with the health care and the medical services, but with this adoption issue, even if the Haitians aren't actually governing and providing legal justice system, it's going to have a Haitian face on it right now.
I mean, another area where you saw that, both on the medical issue but also on the Haitian face issue, is when the initial wave of wounded Haitians were brought to a lot of the U.S. Navy vessels that were off the coast of Haiti, the injuries ended up being much, much more severe than had initially been thought. They knew they'd be bad, but they were, trauma, amputations, burns, I mean, really horrific things. And what happened was typically a hospital ship like the Comfort has some number of beds set aside for really emergency care, some number for convalescent care. They were all filled with people who need emergency care. So the military now working with what's left of the Haitian government, is building on the grounds of Haiti basically a convalescent center of about 1,000 beds so they can try to get people who are on the ships off the ships to heal. And again, it's being done under the auspices of the Haitian government, even though everyone paying it, everyone building it, everyone working there will be American military personnel.
But you've now got Haitians in hospitals in Florida and Atlanta. You've got coordinators in New York, Boston, Philadelphia, and New Jersey put on alert in case there's a need to send patients there. Perhaps the hospitals in Miami are feeling too much of a burden. It really is going to be spread throughout the country.
Well, it's going to be spread throughout the country. And I mean, the United States has committed itself to helping Haiti. So no matter how much, and initially it's, you know, the death count toll is rising, the number of casualties are rising, the injuries are rising. And as, you know, we move from a kind of recovery effort to a rehabilitation and reconstruction effort, we see the enormous damage and the enormous job that has to be done. And every day the United States realizes what an enormous task it's going to be. And it is, because Haiti is so close. This isn't like with the tsunami. Haiti is so close that the American public is going to have to bear some of this burden.
Elise Labatt, she's State Department producer for CNN. Yogi Driessen. He's military correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Brian Bender is national security reporter for the Boston Globe. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Let's talk about the Christmas Day bomber, who is now apparently once again speaking to officials. Why? What's happened? What's changed, Brian?
Well, this is a pretty significant development. Apparently, in the days and weeks after the attack, the Obama administration made an effort to reach out to his family in Nigeria and enlist their help in trying to get him to be more cooperative. Because after initially talking with the FBI, he clammed up. And the Obama administration has been under a lot of fire from Republicans, some conservatives who believe that by keeping him in the civilian justice system, providing him with his Miranda rights, an attorney, all of that, that they have foreclosed on a chance to gather intelligence from this young man about who trained him, what other attacks, perhaps Al-Qaeda, particularly in Yemen, in which he's connected, may be planning. So now what we have, apparently, is sort of a new chapter in which he is being cooperative and is talking to federal officials. So
he's turned against the cleric who claims to have been his teacher, Yogi?
Yeah, he has. I mean, this is the same cleric who's been tied to other plots of violence, both in the U.S. and elsewhere. It's worth pointing out, though, that the issue about whether he's interacting with the government, and if so, why, comes down to this question of, is torture better or is a softer approach better?
Yogi.
And this will get that question fueled again.
Yogi Driessen of the Wall Street Journal. We'll take a short break. We'll come back and talk about Iraq and its elections. And here's our first email from Ron in Ohio. Were those Haitians who were evacuated to U.S. hospitals given passports by the government? What is the difference between the U.S. government taking children and the missionaries taking children? Elise, on that question of passports.
On the issue of passports, no, they were not given passports. They were given emergency visas to come to the United States. They're not being made American citizens, nothing of that nature. They're given, as I said, a temporary protective status. On the issue of adoptions, most of those children were already in the adoption process before they came to the United States. And I think the parents that had already been matched up with children were very nervous, about getting their kids there, quickly. But, all the paperwork was pretty much done on a lot of these kids. They kind of bent the rules a little bit to get them over before, all the I's were dotted and all the T's were crossed. But those adoptions were very much in process before they came, whereas with the missionaries, there was no paperwork whatsoever. They pretty much just rounded up kids that they found on the street.
Here's an email from Barbara in Durand, Illinois. She says, is it correct to say, quote, there is no government, no control, unquote? Do not the laws of state continue in effect regardless of whether at a particular moment the government is unable to function due to destruction of buildings, paperwork, and lack of personnel. Are there not laws that control the situation despite these disabilities, Yoki?
It's a fair question, and the answer, of course, is that there are laws, but just as obviously, if there's no way to enforce those laws, even if they exist on the books, they're somewhat irrelevant. So there is a Haitian government that exists. It has a prime minister and a president. Some large percentage of the parliament survived. It has laws about crime, about adoption.
And by the way, a president who has not been very public since the earthquake, Brian.
Well, I think part of the problem for the leadership of the Haitian government is that in the wake of the earthquake, because of the mass misery, because of the inability of the government to respond, there's a lot of anger among the people, anger at their own government. So it's not surprising that they're trying to lay low. And in addition to that, I think they're probably a little bit embarrassed that the United States and all these other countries are so sorely needed. It sort of is an exclamation point to this concern that they can't handle it.
And now let's talk about Iraq and its election commission, which has delayed start of campaigning for parliamentary elections. How come, Elise?
Well, an Iraqi appeals court this week overturned an effort to bar hundreds of candidates from upcoming elections. Many of these were aligned with Saddam Hussein's former Ba'ath Party. Many of them were members of parliament to begin with in previous elections, and they had already been vetted. But the ban, you know, really threatened to disenfranchise Sunnis once again and open up possible sectarian tensions that we've seen over the last few years. The court overturned this ban. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki had said, you know, no, that's fine. It's unconstitutional to overturn the ban. And so now they've postponed the elections.
So what's that going to mean for the whole government, Yoki?
Well, there's that wonderful line in The Godfather 3 where Al Pacino says, every time I think I'm out, they pull me back in. And, you know, the U.S., we've thought that the war is over, that the violence has stopped, the sectarian tensions are gone, Maliki is a strong leader, we can focus on something else and pull our troops out. And what's been made clear over the last few weeks, both politically, as Elise talked about, but much more horrifically in terms of suicide bombings, one of which destroyed the journal offices and many other offices, and of course, much worse, many human lives at the Hamra Hotel in Baghdad, where I lived myself for close to 2 years.
Really?
The violence is back in force, and what you're seeing is the kind of synchronized attack throughout Baghdad that you saw in the worst days of 06, 07. So this belief that we won was resting basically on two pillars. One, violence was gone. Two, sectarian tensions are gone. What you're seeing now is that both are still back.
I think the seriousness with which these recent developments are viewed here in Washington was evident by the fact that Vice President Joe Biden was sent to Iraq a couple of weeks ago in the wake of this decision to bar these candidates, because there's some real concern that the longer the elections are delayed, the more this friction is there and the violence increases, that you could see things unravel there.
At the same time, here you've got Pakistan and Pakistan, India, offering to resume talks, both atom bomb holders, both very, very strongly protective of their own countries. Why are they willing to talk now, Yoki?
I think that there's more of an understanding now within Pakistan about not just that the Islamist extremism threat there is a threat to their own government, which it is, but that if there's another attack on the scale of the Mumbai attack, that India, which held back and really didn't respond militarily at all, would not do so again. So that if you're the government of Pakistan, you're facing a direct threat to you, and also a once-removed threat that if there's another attack, you'll bear the brunt of an Indian response.
And the United States really wants these talks to happen because it could change the whole dynamic in the region. And if Pakistan could stop being so obsessed with India and move a lot of its troops away from the Indian border, more towards dealing with the Islamic threat, the threat by the Taliban.
What about Kashmir? Is that going to come up as well?
Well, India is offering to have talks about Kashmir. Pakistan wants to have kind of wide-ranging talks which would lead to normalization. I don't think India is really ready for those type of talks right now because of this Mumbai attack, because Pakistan hasn't prosecuted all of those involved. And so Pakistan, you know, it's unclear whether these talks are going to happen. And even if they do, you know, today, actually, everybody, is Kashmir Solidarity Day. And there were thousands of people in Pakistan on the streets today protesting, you know, for Indians to get out of Kashmir. What could happen now is you could see a lot of zealots come out. And if they start talking about Kashmir, we could see Pakistani extremists launching new attacks against India, and that would raise a whole new can of worms and be counterproductive for the talks.
I found it interesting that the suicide attack on Wednesday in Pakistan killed 3 U.S. soldiers and 5 others near a girls' school in the north. They were the first casualties, the U.S. casualties, of a training program there. Now, the significance of that makes me wonder just how involved the U.S. military is in Pakistan.
What we publicly know is for some time, maybe about a year and a half, several hundred U.S. special forces have been inside Pakistan in the northwest, training the Frontier Corps, training them in some operations against the Taliban, but also helping them figure out how to bring some development aid and other projects to some of these communities to offset the Taliban's control. But clearly, this attack has a lot of implications inside Pakistan because it's a very clear reminder that U.S. forces are inside Pakistan, which is very unpopular there, and conspiracy theories fly. So people there may think that this is just, you know, part of a much larger U.S. force that's there. But as far as we know, it's really only a couple hundred troops.
But why have the U.S. and Pakistan tried to keep this quiet, Yogi?
The level of paranoia within Pakistan about the U.S. is staggering. I was there about 10 days ago on a trip with Defense Secretary Gates, and in every interview he did with the Pakistani press and every public speech he gave, he tried to just directly say, I hear the same conspiracy theories you hear. Let me tell you definitively, we do not want your nuclear weapons. We do not want to conquer Pakistan. We do not want to build permanent bases. But the fact that he had to deliver that message every time he spoke is a sign of just how deeply skeptical, paranoid, and unpopular the U.S. happens to be within Pakistan.
So we have about 70 U.S. special ops forces there?
You know, the numbers are a little squirrely because there is, there are special forces training. There are drone bases run by the CIA that operate out of Pakistan, so there's a very large CIA presence. It's very hard to get an exact figure.
And it's unclear whether the Americans were the target. I mean, people believe that they were. You know, this was an open event. They were on their way to the opening of a girls' school that was actually destroyed by the Taliban, and,
right.
and this school was rebuilt. If the Americans were the target, the question is, did the Taliban have help from the Frontier Corps? Were the Pakistanis letting them know about the Americans? There's always been this suspicion that Pakistan is in bed with the Taliban, in bed with the extremists, and this opens up questions as to whether the very people that the U.S. is training the Pakistanis to go against are getting tipped off by the Pakistanis.
And do we know whether the Pakistani Taliban leader, Hakimullah Massoud, was actually killed or not?
Well, we don't really know for sure. We think so. I mean, clearly there are reports out of Pakistan that he was, at minimum, seriously injured in one of these drone strikes a few weeks back. And I think American intelligence officials say they're 95% sure that he's out of the picture,
so,
which is significant.
Why? Why is it significant?
Well, I mean, he's the leader of the Pakistani Taliban, which has been most active in launching attacks across the border in Afghanistan, has also launched a series of attacks against the Pakistani government. And, you know, this is one of the groups in Pakistan that the U.S. and the Pakistanis see as critical in this effort to stabilize that place.
The Washington Post had a story this week saying that Massoud's death would deal, quote, a fatal blow to the Taliban in Pakistan. Was that an overstatement, Yogi?
I think that it was, yeah. I mean, every previous time where there's been a major terror leader killed in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, the impact has faded quickly. I mean, if you think back to Zarqawi was seen as not just the figurehead, but the actual tactical mastermind directing attacks at a given time, at a given place. the highest priority target the U.S. had, really, other than bin Laden and Zawahiri. He was killed. Violence dipped for about a week and then accelerated again a few weeks later. I think believing that that killing any one person is a silver bullet has never proven true.
All right, let's talk about Iran. Opposition leaders are calling for a mass protest, the anniversary of the revolution. What is that likely to achieve?
Well, we've seen that the Iranian opposition has used these holidays as a way for to get out and protest against the government. We've seen a massive crackdown during, between, you know, after each one of these events. And now you've had hangings of protesters, but the opposition is remaining steadfast, and they're saying to get out and protest against the government. I think everybody is waiting to see who comes out. Is it just going to be the kind of opposition movement, or are we going to see the kind of widespread, you know, police, other people? Everyone's looking to see how widespread the opposition is going to be. Is this going to be an opportunity for the opposition to consolidate and expand, or is this going to be another one of these events where they've had the kind of massive crackdown?
Brian, do you think the government was prepared for this kind of opposition protest to continue as long as it has?
I don't think they were prepared, and I also don't think you can overstate how significant this really was. To have these two main opposition leaders basically call on the country to rise up against the government next week is historic. And, you know, this is in the face of death. I mean, they are executing opposition figures and protesters weekly. And the fact that they're going to go out next week in mass, it seems, you know, really could be the beginning of the end.
Brian Bender of the Boston Globe, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. First to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Terry. You're on the air.
Good morning. I was just wondering if there is any way that the press could possibly change the name that they have given to the suicide bomber, because I think that it glorifies more than anything else the most degrading act of murder that there could be.
That's an interesting point. What do you think, Yoki?
You know, this has been a debate within and without the media for some years now. I mean, there's been, particularly in the case of Israel, where there have been advocacy groups that have long argued that to call a Palestinian suicide bomber a suicide bomber is inappropriate, and they should instead be called homicide bombers. Fox News for a long time had done that. It did not catch on in wide usage anywhere else, in part because of the belief that what made the tactic itself so sort of fascinating on some level to many people repugnant isn't killing other people, but is instead being willing to kill yourself to kill other people. And that if you make a change to downplay the killing yourself to kill others, some of what makes these kind of attacks so, for Western eyes, so hard to comprehend gets lost.
Well, I think that it doesn't matter what really you call the bomber. I mean, they did commit suicide. They are a suicide bomber. And it's true that, as Yoki said, they called them homicide bombers. They're bombers. And I don't think glorifying them in any way, whether they're a suicide bomber or anything else. I mean, it's true that Muslims consider themselves martyrs by committing suicide, but I don't think we glorify them in any way by calling them suicide bombers.
Brian.
Yeah, I think most people would say that whatever you call these people, whatever, you know, what they're doing is completely unjustified and is so horrific that no one would even think of glorifying them. So I guess I'm not concerned all that much about the terminology.
You know, I do understand Terry's point. When you talk about suicide bomber, it does focus on the person himself or herself when she or he decides to take their own lives, whereas homicide bomber does, in fact, shift the focus. But as you say, that did not catch on. I want to talk very quickly here about China. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner has said he believes that China would allow its currency to appreciate against the dollar. Is the administration making any headway here, Yoki?
Not really. I mean, in part because China is terrified that the continued slowdown here. I mean, you saw there were new job numbers earlier today that were mildly better on one hand, but very dire on the other. China is very concerned that if the U.S. economy continues to slow, A, their dollar-denominated holdings will fall in value, and B, that we won't be able to buy the tremendous amounts of things they manufacture. So trying to convince China to make what would be a very significant fiscal policy change when they are very, very scared and uncertain about what their relationship with the U.S. will look like in a year because of our own problems is going to be a hard case.
Is pressure from Geithner going to further strain U.S.-China relations?
If it is perceived as pressure.
Yoki Driessen, military correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By Jonathan Cutchins, recognizing NPR's coverage of educational issues across the United States. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
On Sunday, Claire Danes stars in an HBO movie about Temple Grandin. Grandin has written several popular books about being autistic. When she was young, her mother refused to put her in an institution.
Everybody worked with me to keep my brain connected to the world. I was allowed to only have an hour a day after lunch where I could space out and revert back to autism.
Temple Grandin on the next Fresh Air.
Go right back to the phones to Jay. You're in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning to you. Welcome to the program.
Yes, good morning. My point is it's far less expensive to improve Haiti's situation by restoring Haiti's infrastructure and economy in place. I know that to be the fact. And my other larger point is how many third world populations can the country accept? When I was in high school in the late 60s, country's population was 200 million. We're now at 300 million. Economically, we're not a country needing more third world populations. Thank you.
Brian Bender.
Well, I mean, the caller obviously raises an interesting point. But, you know, I guess I would say that at least in the interim, I think rebuilding Haiti in place is easier said than done. I mean, these people need health care. These people need assistance. And right now in Haiti, it's tough to get, even if you're lucky enough to be in a place where there's an international hospital or U.S. military forces. But I do agree that over the longer term, the real solution here is going to be in Haiti, not in Boston or Atlanta or some other U.S. city.
That's why there's a lot of talk about a so-called Marshall Plan for Haiti. They need to rebuild the state from the bottom up. And it's not just about buildings, and it's not just about a healthcare system. It's about, you know, we've seen the international community rebuild Haiti time and time again. The hope is that this time will be the last time. And that's why it has to start with the government, with the institutions that could be a kind of long-term next time if there's an earthquake or a hurricane or something, that the government is strong enough to withstand something like this. I mean, it's a tall order.
Isn't that the debate, though? Isn't Haiti, those who are in place, saying, give us the money, we'll do it our way? And isn't there some debate for that, Yogi?
There is, because Haiti was a failed state before the earthquake. And it was a failed state in large part because of the entrenched political elite personified by the current government. So the notion that just give them tens of billions of dollars and let them do it is not going to fly. But I did want to circle back briefly to the caller.
Sure.
You know, in the immediate aftermath of a disaster like this, everyone appeals to their own better angels. So the whole country says, we'll send what we can. We'll text it. I mean, driving up past the Haitian embassy in D.C., there's still lines of cars to donate goods to the embassy.
Mm.
But there is a real question. And I don't think anyone is talking about transplanting, as he seemed to imply, transplanting Haiti's population to, like, Wisconsin. But there is a question about how do we pay for this? Right now, we are at war in Afghanistan, and that cost is rising rapidly. Still at war in Iraq. Obviously, our economy is in very, very bad shape. At some point, the better angels stop being listened to, and the question becomes a colder one of, can we afford this?
All right. Here's an email from Jeremy. He's in Little Rock, Arkansas. He says, I believe I just heard one of your guests say something along the lines of, the question of whether torture or a softer approach is better will be revisited in reference to the attempted Christmas Day bomber. Without suggesting your guest was condoning or promoting the use of torture and interrogation, is this where our national debate is on the subject? Are we as a nation openly willing to torture suspects and call it torture in the hope of acquiring information? Yogi.
You know, are we willing as a nation to countenance acts that throughout history have been defined as torture? Clearly, yes, because waterboarding had been historically seen as torture. The U.S. itself had prosecuted other nations' military for using waterboarding on our own troops and called it torture. People who support the use of waterboarding would not say it's torture. They use phrases like enhanced interrogation techniques, harsh interrogation techniques, but that we as a nation are countenancing it openly and discussing it openly, 100%. I mean, if you look at what is said not just on sort of the fringes of talk radio, but mainstream debate, Republican lawmakers, elected lawmakers will say, we have to go back to the kind of Bush-era methods. We have to go back to waterboarding. We have to go back to using isolation, using, you know, hard slaps, things that they would say were not torture. And that comes down ultimately to a nomenclature debate, kind of like homicide bombing, suicide bombing. But the substance, waterboarding, isolation, physical slaps, that was openly done in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo for the last 8 years.
But clearly in the case of the Christmas Day bomber, other tactics were used, Brian.
Well, you know, unfortunately, the thing that's missing in this public debate is real factual information about whether torture has worked. There doesn't seem to be a real case that it has. In fact, whether it's the FBI, foreign governments like the Israelis will maintain that it really doesn't work, that building a rapport with some of these detainees over time is more effective. And I think in the case of the Christmas Day bomber, I think time will tell whether or not his cooperation really is going to be a benefit. But certainly the Obama administration thinks that this validates their approach, which is that torture doesn't work and using the civilian system, using this cajoling approach will work.
All right. To Atlanta, Georgia. Good morning, Will.
Yes, good morning. The reason for my call is a comment, and I wanted to perhaps interject a word of caution to individuals on the panel in the way that we inform the public about aid and what we are doing for Haiti and possibly even for other nations. It's true that there is obviously a cost in dealing with this situation, but we can't discount the fact that billions of dollars have come from all over the world and that millions of dollars have come out of charitable organizations in this country that will not cost the American taxpayers one penny. And I think what happens is, in our effort to inform, we sometimes lead the public down a road that says, oh, another hit for the American taxpayer. And that can be very detrimental in gaining support and funding through charitable organizations.
Will, I appreciate your call. Brian.
And I appreciate it, too. Obviously, Will is right. There are many countries, many individuals around the world who are being very generous in giving money to Haiti. But having said that, I think Robert Gates, the Secretary of Defense, told Congress this week that so far the military's bill in this is somewhere on the order of $150 million. And that's just in a couple of weeks. And obviously, that's going to increase. There's no doubt that others are giving, but the U.S. government is also shouldering a larger burden than a lot of other countries are.
You mentioned the various wars, the various places that the U.S. is involved. There is an upcoming NATO strike in Afghanistan that NATO and the Afghan military announced for the Taliban. Say why they did that and what they hope to achieve, Yoki.
This is an operation that will begin in the next few days in a place called Marja in southern Helmand. Marja is one of the few places in Helmand now that does not have U.S. or Canadian or British or NATO personnel operating nearby, so it's thought to be kind of a last major stronghold. It's important to point out some of the press coverage this week has been a little bit off on this because it's argued that this was never done before, that never before had an operation been announced preemptively in detail, which is false. I mean, in 2007 in the summer in Iraq, there was a major operation announced in Diyala province. Diyala province was seen as the major kind of insurgent haven of Iraq. It was announced publicly. The date was announced. The Iraqi government had a press conference. All the trappings you're seeing now happened then. I was in Diyala when that happened. What you ended up seeing was troops rolled in by the thousands, and there was no one there because they had all left weeks earlier. They left behind IEDs by the hundreds, but they were long gone. So the idea that we're going to roll into Marja and be able to sort of have a stand-up fight, much more likely is we'll roll into Marja and it'll be a ghost town with IEDs left behind but no one to fight.
So they've gone elsewhere. So, I mean, is this a sort of rolling battle?
The argument that McChrystal would make in explaining why publicly announcing it makes sense is he says there's a psychological benefit to this, that if we say we're coming and the Taliban stand up and fight, then the U.S. being stronger probably wins and we get a benefit that way. And if they leave, then they look like cowards in the eyes of the Afghans and therefore we win the psychological battle. So for the people who think that this approach makes sense, they think having the Taliban disappear is a net gain for the U.S.
Well, and if the Taliban disappears and they withdraw, then there's a window to rebuild, provide security, and eliminate the safe haven that the Taliban had there. They can minimize casualties. And this is part of the counterinsurgency strategy that McChrystal has been talking about. You know, reducing civilian casualties, convincing the local population that NATO and the Americans and the Afghans are going to protect them. And if they can deliver on those promises, that's a powerful message.
But at the same time, a local Taliban leader in Marja told the nation that they were aware the town was a target. They were going to stay there. He said they would not be intimidated.
Well, obviously, we'll see. But I think they keep it in perspective. U.S. military officials will say that at most there's several hundred hardcore Taliban fighters believed to be in this area, which is not very many. And to Yoki's point, I think this gets to the heart of what the U.S. strategy is: protect the population and build faith in the Afghan government. And in some ways, I think the dividends for this, quote, battle will be much more psychological than they will be tactical.
Interesting. Let's go to Tamarack, Florida. Good morning, Jim. You're on the air.
Good morning. I just want to make a quick comment in regards to all this money that we're donating, as well as other countries that are donating. But we tend to donate a lot of money, and I think that at a certain point in time, we need to come up with like a donation ceiling, like we're trying to do with part of the budget on that kind of stuff. I don't think it's right to be donating all kinds of taxpayer money when there's so many people that are unemployed, are losing their homes, are hanging by paycheck to paycheck. I mean, it almost seems, I hate to say it like this, but it almost seems better to wait until a natural disaster happens and build a business simply to, help rescue and search and get grants and that from the government, because that seems like the only way to do things nowadays is to wait until we donate money and then and try to get a job that way. You know, it seems like the way it is. I'll take your comments off the air. Thank you.
Jim, thanks for calling, Elise.
Well, the caller makes an important point, is that Americans are suffering. Unemployment is high. People do need jobs. I think that America has always been a giving nation. There's always been a certain amount of foreign aid because America is considered the, you know, sole superpower in the world and needs to, you know, show that it's going to be there.
But remember that that foreign aid is less than 1%.
That's right.
Of our total budget.
But it's always, but it has been traditionally very unpopular. I mean, it's faded a bit in the recent years.
Quite
but
right.
I remember in the late 80s, early 90s, foreign aid was seen, it was a huge political issue. And people would think that it was hundreds of billions,
exactly.
But in actuality, it was 13 billion. But, I think the caller, what he's expressing is a real fear. I mean,
and
you see that in the
frustration.
Yeah, you see that in the Tea Party movement. You see this sort of feeling that other people, whether it's bankers getting bailouts on Wall Street, whether it's people overseas, are getting taken care of, and the kind of run-of-the-mill, salt-of-the-earth people are not. And that's a real political issue.
You know, it's true that in the grand scheme of things, this aid money is relatively small if you compare it to the rest of the U.S. federal budget. But I think it's also important to note that beyond the humanitarian need to do this, there's a U.S. national interest in seeing that Haiti is somewhat stabilized, because if this country is sort of left to its own devices and this help doesn't get there, this redevelopment doesn't happen, you know, we're going to see a lot of Haitians getting on rafts and boats and coming to the southern coast of America. So we're helping people, but I think also on some level we're also sort of protecting ourselves.
And at 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Kalamazoo, Michigan. Good morning, Raymond. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. And it is such an honor to be talking with you. And I thank you so much. I'm so grateful that you put me on the air. I just wanted to say that for the most part, there's a tragedy within our family, as calling in as a Haitian American, that 30 people were on the island, but two have been accounted for in our family, from our family. But at the same time, too, and I think it's apropos for Black History Month, that there is a somewhat happy story, a success story to add to this all, and that is that my dad was a graduate of the class of 1910, and at Yale University. He married my mom, who was 100% Haitian. And it was only after he was, with his credentials, was denied entry into medical school and had to go abroad to France, whereupon he met two Haitians who were at the medical school at the University of Sorbonne and medical school. And dad professed his love for Napoleon, and the two Haitian medical students told him that there was nothing to profess love for. As the Haitians, of course, took their independence from the French government, and so dad said one day that he was going to marry a Haitian woman, which he did, and the rest is a story of sorts. We'll be celebrating, and I would hope that the Diane Rehm Show would help us celebrate the 100th anniversary of Dr. Ira McLean Mason's graduation from Yale.
Wow, that's really quite a story. Quite a story, Raymond. Thank you for sharing. Here's a final email, and there have been several similar to this. I do not want to sound churlish, but the need in Haiti, Afghanistan, Iraq, wherever, is truly endless. It seems America is always the go-to country. I'm proud to be part of a country that takes the lead, but I'm dismayed by the cost to our taxpayers and angry about the implication that we are not doing enough, not doing it fast enough, not doing it right. When and where do we ever get credit for our unprecedented generosity? Yogi.
I think that that email summarizes perfectly what will be an increasingly intensely felt feeling in the country and also an increasingly intensely expressed political view here. I mean, the two don't always line up, politics and sort of substance, but I think in this case they will. There is a patience that's running out, and there's an argument to be made in favor of aid, but there's an argument, as is being expressed by a lot of your emails and callers, against it. And for a long time, it's been sort of just the one argument being expressed, not the other. That's going to change.
Yogi Driesen of the Wall Street Journal, Elise Labatt of CNN, Brian Bender of the Boston Globe. Thank you all so much. Take care in this snow that's falling. Have a safe weekend, everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.